Call the committee to order. I'm also going to tell the committee members that there is a hearing, a reception for the great country of Canada today that starts at 5. So if Representative Hoberg will come to the witness table and move her bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, if you want, I can just move it from right here. This is at the chair's direction that he just wants this sent back to the floor. We discussed it and you went to the floor last.
All right. This is a bill from last year that's been passed, heard and passed, so the motion would be to move it directly to the floor on the consent calendar or on the general register?
I think so.
Okay, Representative Hoberg makes the motion to move Senate File 251 to the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Representative Morrow, your bill's up. We could use the short version.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll move House File 1692 since he's not.
Representative Orland moves House File 1692. Representative Morrow, the short version.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair and members, this is the Revised Uniform Arbitration Act. I have Robert Tennyson here today to help me very quickly. We're not going to go through the whole bill, rather just say what the major changes are from the Uniform Arbitration Act, which Minnesota already has, to the Revised Uniform Arbitration Act. But with that, Mr. Chair, I would turn to Mr. Tennyson.
Mr. Tennyson.
Chair, I'm Robert Tennyson. I'm attorney in Minneapolis with Tennyson Law. I'm a Uniform Law Commissioner from Minnesota and here to present the act. I'm filling in for Dean Harry Hainsworth, who couldn't be here today. The Uniform Arbitration Act goes back to 1955. Minnesota adopted in 1957. It's been on the books and used extensively for many years. There have been a few modifications to it. The Uniform Law Conference revised it to reflect some of the changes that have occurred in arbitration in the last 40 years. And these changes are represented in the Act. They are the additions to the Act. Basically, they provide some additional provisional remedies so that during a period when the pending the arbitration, you can maintain the status quo, protect things from being changed without before you can get into the arbitration. Arbitration, as you know, is a consensual matter. It's always between the parties. They're negotiating the contracts, and it's the only time it applies. It provides for some things for consolidation of proceedings if they have similar areas of issues of law and so on. In addition, it's as I mentioned, it's a default act, and you can modify the act and provisions of it except for some provisions dealing with fairness, such as not being able to waive the waive right to an attorney, waive notice, things like that, so you protect the parties. It also has some very important disclosures for arbitrators. It requires them to disclose any potential conflict they would have, financially or otherwise, so they have to disclose that. It also provides for arbitrators to control discovery, things like that. Those are some of the major things, Your Honor. I'm Mr. Chairman.
Representative Orland.
Yes, so I've got two motions that are both author-related. The first of them is A-10-2191, which changes some basic dates. And I would move that.
This would get it into the shape that the author would
right.
prefer?
Yes.
And it just changes dates?
Yep. That one does.
So Representative Orland moves the 2191 amendment. Is there any questions? Representative Hoberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming that next you're going to move the 2115 amendment and it changes what's in the 2191 amendment? Or
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Ms. Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Hoberg, Representative Orland, there's been some confusion on the dates. We're not going to be bringing the second amendment that you just referenced, Representative Hoberg. And Representative Orland, you have my copy of the first amendment. There are some dates that need to be changed from 09 to 2010 on that amendment. And Representative Orland, in other words, amending that amendment just to change some of the
do
dates.
Do you have this amendment?
I do.
I've got the 10-2115 amendment, and everybody should have that one. And I'll tell you what the oral changes that I have to make to his amendment are.
Okay, so as I understand it, the 2015 will change the dates in the 2191.
Mr. Chair, we're ignoring the 2191 completely. The 2115 is the operative amendment. Unfortunately, what we've noticed just coming in here is that some of the dates on the 2115 need to be changed from 2011 to 2010. Mr. Chair, Representative Olin has...
On line 1.2, change the 2011 to 2010. On line 1.3, change the 2013 to 2010. On line 1.8, change the 2013 to 2012. And on line 1.9, change the 2011 to 2010. And that would be the author's amendment to put the bill in the right form.
All right. So this is gets the bill in the shape that the author would like. Does it change any of the premises that Mr. Tennyson brought forth?
Mr. Chair, members, it does not.
Any questions from the committee? Seeing none. All those in favor of adopting the author's amendment as written and as amended, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Members, we have the bill in the author's, the shape that the author would like. Are there any more amendments? Are there any questions? Well, Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if there's any opposition testimony or any opposition to the bill, but it might be worth at least asking that.
Is there anyone who would care to testify against the bill?
Yep.
Testify in opposition? Going once? Going twice? Okay. Any final thoughts?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Holbrook. This has been a matter of work of about 8 to 10 years. The Minnesota State Bar Association now is on board with the bill as amended. Other litigation groups, other lawyer groups are on board now with these changes. We believe there's now happiness in the Valley, and we know of no opposition.
Thank you, Representative Morrow. Are there any other questions? Seeing none. All those in favor? Representative Olin removes his motion?
That's correct.
For House File 1692 as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. You're on your way. To which committee? To the General Register.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Representative, Representative Bigham, do you have 2879? We were on a roll.
Thank you. So these, Mr. Chair, it'd be 1746.
Representative Hillstrom, would you care to move the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Where does it need to go next?
To the General Register.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 1746 be recommended passed and be sent to the General Register.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Bigham?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Today I have a constituent of mine that will give some brief testimony about her experience with inflatable amusement device businesses, and we've had this in two other committees. A couple of you have heard it a couple times now and appreciate the patience. I'm proud to be co-authoring this bill with Representative Coles and Representative Smith. This is, I think, a bill that definitely is needed to make sure we protect the safety of children. And with that, I will let Jennifer explain her experience, and then I will go through the bill briefly, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you again. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Okay, Jennifer Rosenberger. I live in South St. Paul, Minnesota. So, Mr. Chair and members, my son Grant left for a fun-filled birthday party at Pump It Up. The next thing I knew, I had a phone call at 7:57 that Grant fell, hit his head, and wanted me. My mother's instinct was to get him. I had a nursing baby at home, so my husband, who was running errands, decided to go get him. At 8:07, another phone call I made to them, asking how he was, what had exactly happened, and how to exactly get there. 15 minutes later, my friend had to call me. My friend had to say that he was screaming. I could hear him screaming in the background, a scream I had never heard. And then I told them to call 911. So here is my first problem. Where is this trained staff? I had to sign a waiver that there is going to be a trained person watching my child. There was not someone watching my child. They do not know how my child got hurt. They cannot tell me. All they know is from 8-year-old kids and what these 8-year-old kids say. The next big thing that I have problems with is when the EMTs got there, no one from Pump It Up was there. No one from Pump It Up met them to talk with them to discuss that my child is laying on the floor, moving his arms and legs, could not stand, could not talk, and was screaming a scream that was unreal. And again, no one could tell my husband when he walked into Pump It Up. No trained staff ever greeted my family. No trained staff ever called us to see how he was until I called them to ask them what exactly had happened, if they had videos up so that the neurosurgeons at HCMC could see exactly what had happened. So the supervision part of this bill, and this that isn't my whole story, but I wanted to keep it short, but the supervision part of this bill, I understand, is sort of causing some people to be like, well, why do we need that? For one, my son was at a birthday party. I was not there to watch him. I wasn't there to say to other kids, no, you can only have 3 people jumping there. No, you're not supposed to have 5 people on the slide. So the supervision part is a really big thing, and the reason is because the Pump It Ups do not follow the rules. And the rules are so clear when you read the manufacturer laws. So other states have these laws, and so the only thing it's doing is protecting the kids. So I'm begging you from 6 other parents, and that's only 6 that have come through right now, but we're begging you guys to please pass this law so that our children and other children can be protected in these environments.
Thank you, Ms. Rosenberger?
Yes.
Representative Biggin, did you have some comments?
I do. I'm going to briefly go through the bill. I will say, because I think this will be a question, according to my Senate author, 35 or 34 other states regulate this type of industry. The first section of the bill gives the definitions, and I want to be clear, this does not include places that rent out these for parties, so that if Representative Kelly's kids wanted to have a birthday party and have this in the backyard, it would not include those. It doesn't deal with the churches or the schools or community things. So I just want to make that crystal clear. Subdivision 2 is that you can't provide this equipment unless you comply with this new section of law. Subdivision 3 requires ASTM standards against the injuries from falls, which are national standards. We do have the supervision required for one person per inflatable structure, and that is just Valley Fair, like where you have one supervisor per ride. We also require insurance. We have them register with Dolly and pay $100, and Dolly will be doing the enforcing. Currently, one thing that struck me when I had my conversations with Dolly, which is, I don't have to tell you guys, the Department of Labor Industry. Currently, if a child gets hurt and the parents call Dolly to see, you know, to check in and see what kind of regulations or whatever, they are turned away because they don't have jurisdiction. This is a very reasonable bill to prevent injuries and making a bad injury even worse. So with that, I would really appreciate your support on this bill.
Thank you, Representative Biggin. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, have you sought legal action against Pump It Up?
Currently, we have not. I call myself, we call our family lucky, but there is things that we have to deal with on a daily basis with our son. But luckily, they're not life-threatening, and they're not some, he still can play ball, and he can still go outside and play basketball if he wants and play. As far as our medical bill, our medical insurance went after their medical insurance, because we did have a $3,500 bill that we saw for a minute, and then we had to fill out those forms that say, you know, how'd you get hurt, what happened, and then the next thing I knew, I didn't have a bill. So if I would have had that bill, yes, we would have gone after him for that bill.
Mr.
But we do have 18 years. If he started waking up with seizures tomorrow, yes, we would go after him for medical.
Mr. Chair, to that question, the Representative Cole's constituent did seek legal action on it, and she unfortunately, because it's from Victoria, was a longer drive and also had daycare issues for her son, so she couldn't be here with us, but she has testified in the two other committees to that.
Is there a follow-up with Ms. Scott?
Yes, and what was her outcome? She sought legal action. Was she successful?
She sought legal action for her her medical bills, and yes, she did get her medical bills paid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, don't these companies have to carry liability insurance the way it is? I mean, I see that you got the million and the $2 million aggregate. Don't they probably already have insurance to that effect?
Mr. Chair, I have John from Dolly here that could probably give a more for sure answer on that.
Mr. Schultz.
I just don't want to
guess. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Schultz.
And tell us if they have liability insurance.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is John Schultz. I'm a director with the Construction Codes and Licensing Division of the Department of Labor and Industry. And one of my units does administer 184B, which is the amusement ride chapter. Currently, there, because this particular activity is not within the definition of amusement ride, it is not covered by that chapter. Therefore, there is no requirement for companies such as this to be insured at all. They may be, but they're not required to by law.
Representative Scott, does that answer it? Are there any other questions? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know you want to move quick. I'm just, how do you define training? Is there a set training for this type of equipment, or do they watch a video, or?
Mr. Schultz, what would the Department of Labor and Industry say about training?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, it's really dependent on the type of attraction. As you may be aware, they take many forms, size, the different types of interaction by the individuals, and it's part of the ASTM requirement that the training be specific to those particular types of devices, you know, based on their particular need. In some instances, they require more than one supervisor. Some of these attractions are more than 15 foot tall. There may be more than 24, 30 feet square. They vary significantly by size and type. Therefore, there's different training that's required for each type.
So, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Schultz, could you identify what ASTM is?
Oh.
American Standard Testing?
Right.
Materials.
Okay. Just so everyone knows.
It's the American Society for Testing and Materials, which is a national organization that does this. They set standards, and this is what the would govern this particular type of attraction.
Thank you.
So, just for clarification, so they would set the training protocol for each individual type of equipment.
Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, it's actually somewhat a cooperative effort. It's again the manufacturer, as they design and build these attractions, they identify the need based on the type of attraction it is, and then it's in effect it's then agreed to as such by ASTM. Again, there's no definite answer to it because there's any new models, new designs that are coming out all the time.
And just if I might, then the same standard would apply, such as in an amusement ride, if in fact the child was doing something really stupid, or you know, in the case of amusement ride, if you don't buckle your seat or whatever, that there's some liability or negligence on the part of the user that's factored into any claim. Would that be this case in this situation as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, that is true. That is the purpose of the supervisor, is to, in effect, to monitor and control the use of the device.
Mr. Chair, that wasn't my question. My question is the standards of liability. There's still a user of this equipment. If they were using it improperly, they would have to assume some responsibility for the result of their own behavior,
Representative Holbrook, he is, Mr. Schultz is many, many things, but I do not believe he's a legal opinion, so we could go to staff for that, if you'd like.
Whatever your pleasure, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to take that one?
Representative Holbrook, can you repeat the question?
Well, I mean, I'm just, when I'm looking at this, even the most trained individual cannot stop really stupid people from doing really stupid things. And sometimes you have to assume responsibility for your own behavior, such as if you're in an amusement park ride and you stand up and you get injured, you need to be held accountable for your stupid behavior. Would that also be the case in this situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, I think all those facts would come out if the child or the parents of the child were to file a civil suit, the operator would probably try to introduce that evidence as contributing to the negligence of, or contributing to the injury. So
there's, in other words, in this bill, there's no language that would change that standard level of liability for an individual's acts.
Right.
Okay.
Any other questions? Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chair, just a clarification. I know in line 1, 2, 3, prohibition, no owner shall provide an inflatable for commercial use. We have all these town days and festivals. That would not be considered commercial use, correct?
Correct.
Representative Bingham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, correct.
Seeing no other questions, would there be anyone in the audience that would like to speak against this particular bill? Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Any other persons that would like to speak against this bill? Seeing none, this bill thank you. You could have just said that.
Sorry.
Representative Holbrook renews her motion.
Hillstrom.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 1746, General Register?
Correct, sir.
Move to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it.
Division.
All those in favor of this bill going to the General Register, please raise your hand. All those opposed? Ayes have it. Representative Bingham, you are on your way to the General Register. You have another bill, but I think I'm going to hand this off to your Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Bingham, House File 20. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2879. And he referred to
General Register.
Very good. All right, Representative Bingham, to your bill.
Madam Chair, thank you. This is actually a less controversial bill. I didn't think my first one was either. But this bill right now under state law, if a minor owns a car legally, can't obtain insurance. It's unclear. How about I say that? Some insurance companies members say yes, they'll underwrite a policy for a minor, and some say no. And so this bill says is that they will be able to if they so choose. And I know that there is Mr. Bob Johnson from the insurance industry that's going to testify for the bill too, and the DE1 amendment, which I'll need to move to get the bill in the motion or in the form I would like.
Okay, I have an amendment.
I'd like to move the DE1 amendment.
Great. All right, Representative.
It's Mahoney.
Mahoney, I know, but
it's just the beard.
It's the beard.
Yeah.
It's been throwing me off all year. Representative Mahoney moves the amendment. Please explain your amendment.
I will let Mr. Johnson explain.
Madam Chair and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Just very briefly, in working with the chief author on the bill, this is from our perspective, simply language to accomplish her objective in making clear under state law the authority of minors to contract for an automobile insurance policy. It's two-line bills can get very complicated. There are other state laws that affect the legal contract status of minors, and so it's been a little bit trickier to just work the proper sequencing of words, but that's literally what this amendment does. So from our industry's perspective, this accomplishes what Representative Bingham is seeking to do, and we don't have any objections to that.
Madam Chair, I will stand for questions. It's a pretty straightforward bill.
Does anyone have any questions? Yes, Representative Vestkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bingham, Mr. Johnson, what influence do parents have? Does this take away the parents' oversight of their children, and can children operate outside of the, no pun intended on the word operate, outside of the authority of their parents in order to do this?
Madam Chair, Representative Draskowski, no, it's actually what we're trying to do is what sometimes, for example, if I was able to own a car and my father didn't want me to be on his policy, right now I would have no choice then to not drive a car and not, because it's against the law to not have insurance, correct? So right now this just says that if I'm legally able to own a car as a minor, according to current statute, that I can also obtain my own policy, but it has nothing to do with circumventing any permissions or any sort of, permissions to parents.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Vestkowski, you get a follow-up?
Thanks, Madam Chair. So, Representative, I'm not really clear on exactly what... my question is, if a parent says to his or her 17-year-old, or is it 17 or 16? I'm trying to remember. Mm-hmm. Says to their children that, we don't want you owning a car, we don't want you driving a car, we don't want you to have, buy insurance to a car. Okay. Does this allow the child to subvert the will of their parents?
I'd like staff to answer this question.
Madam Chair, Representative Draskowski, I think the way the language is drafted, actually this would permit, it says that the contract would be binding on the minor as in the same basis as if the minor were an adult. So I think that the minor would be entitled to either enter the contract or exit the contract on his or her own decision without requiring consent of the parent.
I have a question. Is there a minimal age? I know that 16 for driving, but that's only for driving a car. Owning and contracting is...
Okay. Madam Chair, just to refer the committee members, in the first line of the amendment is the citation to Chapter 168.101, and that's the statute in current Minnesota law that defines which minors can own, have the title to a vehicle. So the bill is focused on just that category of 17-year-old that current state law permits to have, whether or not they're, the decision between them and their parents, state law permits a 17-year-old to have the title to a vehicle in his or her name. So this bill is crafted, and I think properly, to that group of minors that current state law permits to have the title to a car. If they're permitted to have the title to the car, and they have a driver's license, then they should be able legally and clearly to buy an automobile insurance policy. So from our industry's perspective, that then just kind of ties it all together in a proper way.
Does the insurance industry foresee any issues with a minor's capacity or not to understand the policy, so that if something goes awry, because, 16-year-old...
Madam Chair, actually, this law, it wouldn't reach to 16. If you had a copy of 176.101, I think it's Subdivision 1 in front of you, you'd see, and I think it's just 17-year-olds in the defined categories.
Okay. Then 17-year-olds.
17.
But, I mean, since generally speaking, I realize that we have this exception for ownership, but generally speaking, we've got 18 as age of majority and legal disability for anybody underneath and inability to contract. So how do you get over the issue of a 17-year-old's maybe lack of understanding of a policy if there's a dispute over coverage afterwards?
Yeah, I think, Madam Chair, the only comment I'd make, it's actually there's a lot of individuals that might fit in the category in terms of trying to understand what's in an insurance.
Sure. Right. I understand that, but we're working with a special group of
sure.
people.
Sure. Well, here's my comment. I think at least the way that our state has chosen to deal with that issue is that automobile insurance contracts are required under Minnesota law, it's Chapter 72C, to be written at a ninth grade reading level. And then the disclosures about that take place at the time of sale in terms of a lot of features of the contract, it's intended, that's really the basis of state law in terms of communicating to buyers what's in the coverage, what's in the automobile contract, and there's a lot of reliance obviously on the agents that they're, you know, that are licensed by the state and are regulated to have that mechanism be. That's really as good an answer as I can give you in terms of communicating what's in the contract, helping the buyer to know what it is, and done by people who are licensed, both the companies and at the agent level, that are fairly extensively regulated as the mechanism that we as a state do to help people understand what they're buying.
Okay. Back to the amendment. Are there any other questions about the amendment, the DE1, because we need to adopt that? Any more questions about that? All right, hearing none, all those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, then any further questions on the bill? I know I have one. And what was it? It's gone. It's like Mahoney. Any other questions? Discussion? No, I wasn't comparing myself to you. I was comparing my inability to remember your name, Representative. One of those days.
Yeah, I forget a lot of things.
I know. Oh, I know what the question was. What if a parent communicated to you in writing that they objected to the child, the 17-year-old's policy? How does the insurance industry plan to handle that?
Well. Madam Chair, I mean, the point is that if state law lets somebody have a license, have the title to a car, and they come to buy it, I think that from our industry's perspective, we should treat them as capable as the state has deemed them capable.
So they'll just work.
Drive, own, and buy the insurance, so I think we would treat it that way.
All right. Any other questions? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? All right, seeing a further discussion, Representative Mahoney renews his motion that House File 2879, as amended by the DE1 amendment, be passed and referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And motion carries.
Thank you, committee members, on both the bills. Thank you.
All right. Representative Hortman. Oh, yes. While we're waiting, I will entertain a motion to approve the minutes of the Wednesday, February 24th meeting. Was that a yes?
Yes.
Oh, Representative Drazkowski, thank you for that motion.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
That doesn't occur a second, does it? Good. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Great. Motion passes. And the minutes are approved. Okay, now I want to put all this in front of me. Okay, thank you. Representative Hortman. All right. Is there a motion to move this bill?
Where does it go, Madam Chair?
That's a great question.
The
General Register?
Madam Chair, I will move that House File 2825 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register.
All right, we have the bill before us. Representative Hortman, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill is, I'm carrying it for the probate and trust section of the Minnesota State Bar Association, and I have two members of the section to explain the bill, and I will let them do that.
Thank you, Representative Hortman. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Scott Nelson. I'm in private practice and co-chair of the Legislation Committee, and to my left is Peter Hattinen, who's my co-chair on the Legislation Committee. And we have before you today the proposal from the Probate and Trust section of the Bar Association for this year, and we have three main parts of our bill, and the first part is Section 1, the second part is actually Section 11, and then the third part is Sections 2 through 10. So to help with the ease the presentation a little bit, I'll start with Section 1, which is a proposal to change a principal in trust accounting, which is different in many cases than tax accounting. And it basically would clarify that for a very small segment of the trust administration area, basically relating to real estate investment trusts and regulated investment companies. These are very specific entities that are recognized separately by the Internal Revenue Code. We're basically clarifying that any distributions from those entities for trust accounting purposes will be treated as capital gains. Will be treated as any distributions from capital gains, whether they're short-term or long-term, will be treated as principal distributions rather than income distributions. And this follows consistently what trust accounting principles have generally provided. Capital gains are generally defined as accretions to the asset value, which is basically the principal part of the trust, and not the income is generally the income that's generated by the principal. And all we're clarifying is that for purposes of trust accounting, if it's a distribution from capital gains, it'll be treated as coming from principal, whether it's short-term or long-term. And there's been some confusion about that because the tax law does differentiate between short-term gains, which are generally gains generated within a year, and long-term capital gains, which are gains generated over more than 12 months. So that's our first proposal. Like I said, there's been some confusion among trust accountants trying to determine whether those should be treated as principal or income for distribution purposes. So that's Section 1 of our proposal. Section 11 of our proposal, which I'll go to next, because again, that's just one section of the Act, is a proposal from our section to allow the appointment of an emergency conservator by the probate court. And in our guardianship conservatorship law, currently we differentiate between guardians, who are the individuals appointed to handle an individual's personal matters and health care matters primarily, and conservators, who are primarily appointed to handle the financial matters for the ward or the conservatee. And right now in our statute, we have a provision that allows emergency appointment of guardians. So if for some reason there, you know, a guardian is terminated or dies or is removed for wrongdoing and there's no successor guardian in place, we have a statute which I've cited in the summary that you may have in front of you at Section 524.5-311, which allows appointment of an emergency guardian. But we don't have a companion provision that allows appointment of a conservator on an emergency basis. And we've had a few cases arise in the probate court where, you know, a conservator was removed or, like I say, may have died or become incapacitated, and there was no mechanism to appoint a replacement conservator on an emergency basis. So we've basically taken the same language that we already have for appointment of an emergency guardian and added a new provision that allows a similar mechanism for appointing an emergency conservator when necessary. So that's Section 11 of the Act. And then the last part of our bill is Sections 2 through 10, which basically is a series of changes to our existing uniform probate code. And the impetus for these changes actually came through the Uniform Law Commissioners, who in 2008 proposed amendments to the Uniform Probate Code on a national level. And so at the state level, our Bar Association has gone through the amendments proposed by the Uniform Law Commissioners, and before you today, we're presenting a portion of those amendments that we have approved at the Bar Association for consideration by the legislature. And basically what the changes involve that we have presented to you right now are changes to update our Uniform Probate Code to recognize the current practices of assisted reproduction and also to recognize some of the legal principles involved with adoption, whether it's adoption of an adult or a minor child. So basically what you have in front of you are a series of changes to our Uniform Probate Code to recognize children who may be conceived through artificial reproduction or children who may later be adopted, and basically recognizing the legal relationships that are created as a result of that. So again, we have quite a few technical changes to the Uniform Probate Code to try to recognize the modern science and the modern practice of how we define a parent and a child. And the other quick thing that I just want to mention about these changes is that this is a section of the statute that deals with what we call intestacy, which basically means the individual has died without a will or a trust to direct how their estate plan should be distributed. So this is a default provision, and what we try to do in this section of the Uniform Probate Code is reflect what the common person would normally understand is going to happen with their estate upon death if they don't have a plan already in place. So kind of the converse comment about that is that no matter what we put into the statute in this section, people can always draft around that if they don't agree or want to add somebody that maybe wouldn't be included. An example of that might be, for example, if a child is adopted under our Uniform Parentage Act, which is a separate provision of our statutes, normally that happens if a parent has basically renounced their right to continue to be the parent of that child. So normally the expectation would be in that circumstance that the child is not going to continue to be a descendant of the natural parent who, basically is no longer parenting that child. And the idea that we would normally assume is that the adopting parent would become the natural, become the parent through whom they would inherit. So the idea here is that we're trying to clarify what normally people would expect, when a person dies and who's going to inherit. And we also have the inverse situation. If the child dies, normally, by law, what happens is if they don't have descendants, their estate will go to their parents. Well, again, if we have a parent who has renounced their responsibility to be the parent, we would no longer expect that parent's going to inherit the child's wealth. So, again, we've tried to design this statute to clarify how those relationships are changed and how they're going to interact in situations either where they're adopted or where they're born by assisted reproduction. Okay. And then we also have an author's amendment, and I don't know if
everyone have the amendment marked A10-2173. And would someone on the committee like to move the amendment?
I'll move.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, this is, and members of the committee, this is just primarily some technical changes that we found after the bill was introduced that were slightly different than the draft that we had sent over for presentation. And then we also added an effective date provision, which was not in the original draft that was presented to this committee.
Is there any discussion to the amendment? You've got a question. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I would have, contrary intent in the instrument, what, help us out with the meaning there, or maybe what are some examples of what might end up being contrary intent in the instrument?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, could you just mention which line you're on?
Effective date on the amendment?
1.10 on the amendment.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the effective date provision is meant to clarify that these changes will apply to instruments that were drafted before the effective date unless there's contrary intent. So what we're concerned about there is to make sure that that because we're changing some of these definitions in the Uniform Probate Code, let me back up. If there are situations where instruments that were drafted prior to the effective date do make reference to our intestacy law. So in other words, sometimes the drafters will actually default to the statute and say, this is what we intend when we say heirs at law, or you know, maybe they have other definitions in their instrument. So what we're clarifying with the effective date is if they have instruments that make reference to the intestacy code, we apply the changes that we're discussing today unless there's a contrary intent already expressed in the instrument that they drafted.
If I can ask a follow-up question to that, so to make sure that I understand, if my will says, you know, if all my lineal descendants predecease me, then I would like my estate to be distributed to my heirs at law as defined in the Uniform Probate Code of a specific year, then that would be considered the contrary intent and the definition of heirs at law as existing at the time that I cited, right, would be followed.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay. All right. Any other discussion to the amendment? All right. All in favor of Representative Mahoney's amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. And the motion passes. All right. Back to the bill as amended. Any other discussion or questions? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at page 7 of the bill, line 7.9, and I just need maybe help understanding it better. Line 7.11 and 7.12 is kind of in the area I'm looking at. So if, as I read that quickly, if in kind of a look back type of mode, there was somebody was behind on child support or something like that. It says non-support. What does non-support mean there? I guess is that was a word that grabbed my attention.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, this section is dealing with the example I cited earlier where the child dies without descendants, and the question is who inherits the child's estate. And you know, normally again the expectation would be the natural parents of the child, you know, unless there was an adoption or some other issues. And basically this section is saying that if the child is not 18 and has passed away, then you know, unless there's clear and convincing evidence, or there is clear and convincing evidence that the parent you know, basically was no longer intended to be the parent of the child, you know, basically the parent would not inherit. So again, there would have to be clear and convincing evidence that the parent's rights could have been terminated. And I don't believe under our Uniform Parentage Act provision that the failure to pay child support would be enough to terminate a parent, you know, a parent's rights. They might have a legal claim for collection of the child support against the
parent who wasn't paying, but I don't believe there's any basis for terminating the parental rights of a parent who's behind in child support.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the word non-support, is there somewhere in statute that gives a definition of what that means, or will it be construed by the courts? To how will that play out? I guess that's the word that I'm looking at.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't believe I have that answer in front of me. Like I say, I believe we would have to refer to the provisions in the Uniform Parentage Act and also probably the Marriage Dissolution Act to determine the answer to that question.
I have a question. Is it your understanding, though, that whatever behavior of the parent that there was would have to have risen to that threshold to warrant termination of parental rights by clear and convincing evidence for this to apply? Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. And unfortunately, like I say, that would be covered by some other parts of our statute, you know, again, dealing with parental rights.
Do you know if this language with the sort of the list of various, you know, rationales for that, did this come out of the Uniform Parentage Act?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I cannot answer that 100% for sure. Like I say, it came out of the Uniform Law Commissioners, which of course also have drafted the Uniform Parentage Act, but I cannot speak directly whether it came from our version of the Uniform Parentage Act.
All right, thank you. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think some of this wording may well be in the act of, better known as CHIPS, Children in Need of Protection and Services. Some of this type wording looks vaguely familiar to something I've seen as a county attorney
in the past.
Oh.
But I'm not.
All right. Any other questions? Any more discussion? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Seeing no further discussion, I guess it was Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 2825, as amended, be passed and referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. And the motion carries. All right.
Thank you.
All right, the next bill we have for consideration is House File 2819. Representative Mullery, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd move House File 2819.
And would that be referred to Public Safety Policy and Oversight?
Does it go there?
Yes.
Okay.
Then all
it
right.
goes there. I'd move that it go there.
All right, we have the bill before us. And Representative Mullery, mm-hmm. to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is basically a problem that just happened because I don't think I was here when it happened, but the legislature didn't coordinate two different sections of the statutes, and we looked into it. I met with Katie Engler, who does the data records issues and privacy for the Department of Public Safety, and she explained what the effect is. right now, records which are not public, even with the a consent form signed by the youth. Some police departments give them out because the statute doesn't clearly prevent that. And the legislature put in a specific provision that that would not be true for minors' records. But because they forgot to put that also into a provision that said that local police couldn't give them out under that circumstance, some local police are giving them out, and there's a discrepancy across the state. But it's clear that the legislature intended that those not be given out, and so we're just trying to make that clear that no one gives them out, and that's what it is. And this with me today is Mark Housey from the county, from the Council on Crime and Justice, Freddie English, who is, I believe, presently a probation officer, formerly a teacher, and also the either Nancy Haas or Dave Brown from the county attorneys all support this. So,
all right,
Mr. Haas, you'll
Mr.
be
Haase.
First.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll be brief. I don't have much to add to Representative Mallory's description. I'm with the Council on Crime and Justice, and often in our advocacy programs, we hear from parents, young adults, others who wonder why private juvenile records come up when they're applying for jobs or housing. And we did some research into this, talked to various people, and we actually, talking to police departments, I had an intern this last summer call about a dozen different police departments across the state, and about half of them said they did release juvenile private records with informed consent, and about half said they didn't. So, for example, Madam Chair, in your county, the police departments might be, you know, releasing records to people on juveniles, but in the next county over, they might not be. And so there's an issue of consistency between, you know, for young people across the state. As Representative Mallory indicated, the BCA record statute clearly already says that juvenile private records should not be released even with informed consent. The courts do not release juvenile private records with informed consent. And when I say private, that means it doesn't apply to, you know, certain 16, 17-year-old proceedings that have been made public already. It doesn't apply to adult certifications, failed EJJ proceedings. The records can still be accessed for human services disqualification, for working with vulnerable adults and children. It just, you know, makes it so those private records are truly private, so that an employer can't say, you know, sign this form and I'm going to go to the police department and get that record of arrests. And there's roughly 50 to 60,000 juvenile arrests across the state of Minnesota in a year. So this would impact a huge number of, potentially impact a huge number of juveniles.
And Madam Chair, I just want to make clear that we're not trying to change what is and isn't private. We're just trying to make it consistent, and the legislature very obviously put in the intent in the BCA statutes that these kind of records not be, and they not be given out, and it just didn't happen to get in. Nobody correlated and forgot, or they forgot to put it in the
so
other.
So then, Representative Mallory, would this then conform peace officer records to BCA record
right.
handling? All right.
Yes.
Representative Holberg.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I have a number of questions. In the case of the agencies that were giving out, who was giving the informed consent? Was it the juvenile or was it the parent?
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, a juvenile cannot, under statute, give informed consent. It's a young adult giving informed consent to release their juvenile record.
And Madam Chair, if I might, in the case of a juvenile, cannot a parent provide that information be released on behalf of their 15 or 16-year-old?
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, I believe you're correct.
And Madam Chair, if this bill passes, if I have a youth that is in trouble and I want them to, say, get into a boot camp or a treatment program, et cetera, and for cases of admittance into that program, I need to provide the juvenile records of my son or daughter. If your bill passes, will I be able to get those for that purpose?
Representative Mallory or Mr. Housey?
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, if you look through the current statute, there's provisions in there for release to law enforcement agencies to schools. This does not change release to other agencies that's already permitted by law.
And so can you tell me where in this I could get it as the parent?
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, I can't. I can research that. I don't know if there's another provision that would allow that. You may know the answer.
Madam Chair, I think this language is really broad, and I do think that the point has to be made that the difference in access at the BCA versus at the local level was, in fact, not an oversight, but a policy decision that tried to address the issue of people going to the BCA on fishing expeditions and having access to aggregated data statewide, years and years of stuff, and where at the local level you'd have to have more of an idea of did it actually exist at the local level. It's not easy to go to all the different police departments. We need to be really careful here that we're not taking parents' rights away, and that there are necessary reasons for people to have access to juvenile records, in which this language, at least as I read it, takes away any discretion of the family, or in fact there may be things like Job Corps, etc. They want to have these records, but you list all these exceptions here and it's all government agencies that can get it, but you've from my read, completely taken away the family or parental ability to govern whether or not they have access to these records and their dissemination.
And Representative Holberg, you're referring to parent of a minor child.
Well, and even an individual. If I'm a 20-year-old and I'm trying to get into something and they want to know my history and I want to get into a particular program or whatever, why can't I?
Right, I understand. I was actually asking about if my child is now 25, if your question had to do with getting access to your child's juvenile records while the child's still a juvenile rather than when
correct.
The child's an adult. Okay.
But I mean, I this is extremely broad language, shutting down all access unless you're one of these exceptions.
Representative Mowry?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I don't understand the argument at all. This isn't applied to harvesters of data. This is only if you have a written consent by the person. And so the argument that the provision in the BCA statute to prevent this doesn't make any sense that's against harvesters, because it's only with the written consent of that person. So that isn't why it was put in the BCA statute. The reason was to protect the record, and that's why I think it's obvious that it wasn't intended to have. Why would we protect the BCA, the individual, from sign? It just doesn't make any sense to argue that the individual who the legislature decided to protect with that language in the BCA statute would say, oh, but you can go around over here and get it.
Well, Madam Chair, I can give you one example.
Representative,
if you completely locked down all information, you wouldn't even be able to know if somebody was under arrest and being held at your local law enforcement place. So, I mean, that's one of the rationalizations for having some of this stuff open at the individual police departments, and I'm not talking that a juvenile being held would be public information, that's not what I'm saying, but there are differences of data being held in big, huge databases at the BCA and access to those, and I'm not talking about data harvesters here at all. I'm talking about parents and their ability, and individuals and their ability to have control of the use of records about their lives.
Madam Chair, I don't think it's being understood. Right now, it's private, and for an adult, you can sign, I believe for an adult record, you can sign a written consent to release it to a prospective employer. the legislature decided that for youth records that shouldn't be done, and so they put that statute into the BCA part. We're just trying to make that apply to those local agencies.
I understand, Representative Moore. I think what Representative Holberg is talking about is the ability of a parent of a still minor, maybe 17-year-old, to obtain a release of that 17-year-old's juvenile record. Representative Champion.
Is it possible that what you see as potentially the challenge, Representative Holberg, is answered on page 1, specifically lines 1.2 to 1.5, where it says, our private data but shall be disseminated, then when you look at number 4, it says, to the child or the child's parents or guardian, unless disclosure of a record would interfere with the ongoing investigation. Perhaps that gets to the notion of discretion and allows for the child's parent or the child to request this information that they are the subject of. Would that be consistent in your mind, testifiers?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Or to the child or the child's parent.
Well, perhaps I should ask it again because it looks like the testifiers were talking at the time I was asking the question that I thought would help clarify the concerns of Representative Holberg. From my understanding, Representative Holberg's concerns centers around the child or the child's parent to be able to access these records that are private. I said if we look at 1.12 to 1.15, and specifically on line 1.14, it says this information shall be disseminated to the child or the child's parents or guardian unless disclosure of the record would interfere with an ongoing investigation. And my question was, in your mind, would that answer Representative Holberg's question, and does it get to the discretion concerns that she has so eloquently articulated?
Representative Mueller.
Representative Champion, I guess we're not understanding what's coming forth, because this is, they're talking about protecting the child. If you can let Ms. English testify as to what the problems are here, it maybe would clear up and help, so that if we could get to Ms. English, I think, or Ms. Haas, maybe that would help clear up what we're trying to get
through. Although before we go on, Representative Holberg, does the shall be kept separate but shall be disseminated in the list is included to the child or the child's parents or guardian? Does that?
Well, Madam Chair, from the way I understand this would work is that, go back to my boot camp thing, if they want records, then generally you sign a consent for release of records to be sent to the boot camp. And if you look at the new language here, no consent to release is effective. I mean, they're in conflict with each other. And, you know, Madam Chair, I just think this is really poor policy. And I the second half of the sentence, if somebody can explain to me what that means, release of information in a manner that reveals the existence of a record. If you disseminate a record that has a juvenile's name redacted out of it, is that releasing information in a way that allows the existence or shows the existence of a record? I mean, I'm not sure what that even means.
Madam Chair, may I comment on that?
Yes,
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, that language is directly lifted from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension statute on private juvenile records, on the informed release issue. So
if I might, if you then, if a thing is all redacted with all the juvenile stuff taken off, then that's okay? It wouldn't be in violation of this language?
Representative Mallory or Mr. Housie? In the meantime, Representative Holberg, and maybe I'm not, I thought I was understanding where you were coming from, but if this private data shall be disseminated to the child's parent or guardian, then it appears to me that the statute would allow you to access that information and send it on to whatever agency you wish.
Well, Madam Chair, in some instances, that's not how people want information. They don't want information to pass through a parent's hands on a way to some type of entity. They want to get it directly from the law enforcement agency, similar to getting a transcript directly from a college or whatever. Integrity of documents sometimes require that information not pass through the hands of a family member, but in fact are available directly from the entity that holds that record.
Mr. Hasi.
Madam Chair, I think that last statement, Representative Holberg, kind of gets to the point of this is these juvenile records are intended to be treated differently than adult records because they're juveniles. The whole intent of the juvenile system is rehabilitation, and if third parties can get records directly from the law enforcement agencies, then these individuals are going to have a hard time moving on with their lives. And that's really, the point here is to help the juveniles and their parents in moving beyond their juvenile mistakes. And that's what I think that Representative Mullery wanted Ms. English to speak on.
Yes. We have another testifier. Please identify yourself for the committee.
Madam Chair and committee. I got a little confused, but I do know why I'm here. I am a member of the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee for the state of Minnesota, appointed by the governor. And our job is to provide advocacy and information in regards to juvenile issues. One of the issues that we have taken up is the records on juveniles.
I'm sorry, did you state your name?
I'm sorry, Freddie Davis English.
Thank you. Please continue.
And one of the issues that the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee has taken up is juvenile records and the concern that much of our work is to help youth and their parents reintegrate them into the community and be good law-abiding citizens. However, there have been several instances and many instances where records of the juveniles, which most juveniles believe that once they do something stupid or not so smart, and come in contact with the law, that it just goes away because they're not found either guilty or they're not charged. But have found that in instances that information does come up once again, and when they're interested in being involved in something, that it affects that. So the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee has become very interested in this, not only in the urban areas, but also in outstate areas that we've had issues. So we are supporting this bill and want to look further as to how we can ensure that there's some clear guidelines about the release of information on juveniles so that it does not affect them in ways that will continue to have us have to be involved in their lives.
Representative Holberg.
Well, Madam Chair, to the testifier, aren't there instances where the release of the juvenile record is integral to the well-being of the juvenile or other juveniles? I mean, if you have treatment facilities where you house a number of juveniles together and they can't get a good read on the criminal background of their population and so that they can make good decisions about how they should be housed and who should be protected from whom, isn't that in fact counter to what you're pushing?
I guess I'm not speaking to that because I did not mention, I've been involved in the juvenile justice system for about 37 years. 21 of those were in a juvenile justice correctional institution and also probation, also as the detention superintendent. What I'm speaking of about the records, not that the professionals cannot access those records, it's individuals outside of that. There are times when I think the system has worked very hard over the last 15 years to share records. We've had lots of problems in the area because of confidentiality. But we've worked very hard to share records for the benefit of the youth and their families. However, because of the media age, we do have information that gets out on juveniles that might not be supportive to their continuing to become productive citizens. That's what I'm speaking of.
And
Representative
Madam
Butler.
Chair, I agree with everything that you said, and I think that you and I probably would be on the same page 90% of the time on what you're trying to accomplish. But not every facility that a child might be referred to or a parent might want to send their kid to is a government agency with, you know, ability to interact without consent to release of records. It's the exceptions in here don't cover some choices that parents might want to make on behalf of their children. And in fact, you would probably be better off in your approach rather than to have a section I in which you basically said you can never consent to any kind of release, consent to release is not valid. You might be better off looking at an approach of putting more constraints or limits or something, but okay. You've basically in one sentence undone major portions of this whole section of law that have been worked on for a long time.
We still have two more bills, and I'm going to recognize Representative Champion and try and wrap up the discussion. Representative Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What it appears as if to me is that the subject or parent can in fact request the information, but it appears as if the subject or the parent signs a consent form, that it is the consent form itself that will not be honored. And so my question is, if that's accurate, what's the reason for that, and how might that help not only the child but also the parent have the leeway or the discretion to request the information, but yet instead protects the child's records by making sure that that consent cannot be authorized through a consent form. Do I have that correct?
Representative Mallory.
Representative Champion, your explanation of what it is absolutely correct. We think that number G applies to Representative Holberg's issue, and obviously number one, by order of the juvenile court, you could always get that if you really needed it for that.
All right, any other discussion to this bill? And is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill?
Madam Chair, if I can. Nancy Haas with Messerly and Kramer here today on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Our association has not taken a position specifically on this bill, only because our committee has not yet met. However, we have discussed this issue a number of times over the last 6 months and agree with the general concept of it. And a lot of our folks were particularly supportive of the concept that Representative Holberg was bringing up related to the boot camp scenario, where because juveniles were required to produce their record, and different police agencies complied or didn't comply with BCA, and then these kids were not getting in to their boot camp. And so while this language may not be perfect, that's the intent of at least our support of the general concept.
Thank you. Representative Westrom.
Madam Chair, I guess just a general overall question to Representative Mullery or the Ms. English. Is the purpose to tighten up juvenile records, and where I'm going with this is just the question of, you're familiar with the Emily's Law that we've tried to push and other juvenile heinous acts. Is it going to be tougher for people at 18 and 19 years of age to find out if somebody's killed somebody as a juvenile or done other heinous acts, or won't that be affected?
Mr. Hasse.
Madam Chair and Representative Westrom, this bill only applies to private juvenile records. If they are certified as an adult, that's a public record, so it would not apply to that. So the heinous, you know, acts you're referring to, you know, would either require or have adult certification. Also, things like predatory offender registration laws would still apply and require registration.
Madam Chair.
Representative Westrom.
If they aren't certified as an adult, that gets to the issue of the Emily's Law. At under 14, they're not able to be certified, and so how would it affect that situation if they're not certified?
Mr. Hazy.
Madam Chair, Representative Westrom, if it's a private juvenile record and they weren't certified, they didn't fail an EJJ program, that would be correct.
Madam Chair, just as
Representative Mallory.
As it, before it reaches Representative Hellstrom's, we'll check with Katie Engler from BCA and see about Representative Holberg's issue here and just what language.
All right. Thank you. Representative Mallory, do you renew your motion?
Yes.
Okay, that House File 2819 be passed and referred to Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay?
No.
The ayes have it.
Division.
All right, all those in favor, please raise their hand. Nays, raise their hand. 7-5, and the ayes have it.
Thank you.
Motion carries.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Has anyone else requested House File 2990? I think I did. Or does it need to go to GovOps? Okay.
All right.
Madam Chair, I move that House File 2990 be recommended to pass and be sent to GovOps.
All right. We have the bill before us. Representative Hillstrom, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill was brought to me by the state court administrator, and I have Ms. Dosell with me to talk about the bill.
Ms. Dosell, would you please identify yourself for the committee?
Madam Chair and members, my name is Sue Dosell. I'm the state court administrator. Just generally, what this bill will do will transfer the guardian ad litem function from under the administrative control of the judicial branch to an independent board. That's what's proposed. Let me give you just a little background. In 1974, Congress mandated the appointment of a guardian ad litem in every juvenile case in alleging abuse or neglect of a child as a condition of foster care money for states. A year later, Minnesota enacted its parallel statute and extended guardian ad litem appointments to family cases in which abuse or neglect is alleged. Guardians ad litem are appointed to conduct an independent investigation to determine the facts relevant to the situation of a child and family. This includes meeting with and observing the child in the home setting and considering the child's wishes as appropriate, interviewing parents, caregivers, and others with knowledge relevant to the case, gathering relevant medical and psychological information, and interviewing teachers and other school contacts. Guardians ad litem advocate for the best interests of the child and for appropriate community services, and they present to the court written reports and recommendations concerning the child's best interests. While other parties in the case are concerned about the child, the guardian ad litem is the only person in the case whose sole interest is the best interest of the child. Guardian ad litem input is one of the several important issues that are considered by the judge in making an informed ruling in this area. The hallmark of the guardian ad litem's role is that it is an independent voice concerning the best interests of the child that is not influenced by any other party's interest or position. In 2001, the guardian ad litem function was transferred from county funding to state funding and under the auspices of the judicial branch. And today, the guardian ad litem program is an integral part of the court system. Program coordination, training, technology support, and legal services are part of the state court administrator's office. The HR and finance functions are coordinated through each of our judicial district offices, And the whole program is supervised and funded by the courts and is subject to all of the rules and policies of the judicial branch. The reason that we're here is because in 2007, after 6 years of operation under state funding, the Judicial Council, which is the governing body of the judiciary, formed a broad-based 26-person guardian ad litem advisory committee to take a look at this program and to consider the long-term and systemic challenges that are faced by the guardian ad litem program and possible solutions to those. One of the issues that was considered by that committee was the ongoing concerns voiced over the years about the conflict of interest or the appearance of a conflict of interest of guardians ad litem, the judiciary appointing and paying guardians ad litem, who are a party to the case before the judiciary. Now, no case type handled by the judiciary engenders more emotion than issues of child protection and termination of parental rights. Some people go so far as to say that it is the civil equivalent of a capital case. So trust and confidence in the judicial actions and orders is dependent upon the belief in the impartiality and the fairness of the process. Tribal representatives, public defenders, the ombudspersons for families and mental health, and judges themselves have expressed concern about this conflict of interest issue. And for that reason, this guardian ad litem advisory committee ultimately recommended that an independent board should be established to govern the GAL program. The issue of conflict of interest is not unique to Minnesota. Several other states are in the process of studying this issue. A number of them have actually taken action to move the GAL program out from under the administrative control of the judiciary. The Judicial Council reviewed this issue at some length and ultimately agreed with the recommendations of the GAL Advisory Committee that an independent entity be created. And so thus the bill that you have before you, Mr. Chair, and members.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have an A1 amendment. This bill creates a board much like the Public Defenders Board, and this says that during the transition that the court, the Judicial Council, may authorize program expenditures until the board is established. So it would not be okay to create the board and then not have any way to pay for it. This is not asking for new money. This is just the moving of money that is already allocated for these kinds of programs. So I would move the A1 amendment, Madam Chair.
All right. Any discussion to the amendment? Then all in favor of Representative Hillstrom's amendment A1, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion carries.
Madam Chair, there is another issue that we will need to deal with as the bill continues to move. We need to make certain that we comply with the Indian Child Welfare Act, and so that issue will be addressed as we move forward. This has a number of stops. Again, it has to go to government operations because it's creating a new board. It has to come back to my committee, and it has to end in Representative Paymar's committee. So I believe that all of the other issues that I am aware of have been addressed, Madam Chair, but it really does make a board much like the public defenders, exactly modeled after the public defenders, to deal with this issue in a way that is not biased for the court.
Any other discussion to the bill or questions? Representative Scott.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I just haven't read far enough here, but I'm looking over it says the terms compensation, I'm reading from page 3.29 and following. The terms compensation and removal of members shall be as provided in section 15.0575. I'm not, I don't know that statute right off the top of my head, but would you be able to address the compensation and how this is going to be paid for and that sort of thing, please?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hildstrom.
Could you tell me where you are again? I'm sorry.
Oh, sure. Page 3.29. 2.29, the end of that sentence, and then 3.30 down to 3.31.
Ms. DeSalle. Madam Chair and member, that is the standard statute that deals with state boards, just the provision for that. In terms of the compensation of the members, we don't expect that there will be any compensation other than expenses.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. Mr. Gearing just handed me the statute book, and it says here members of the board may be compensated at the rate of $55 a day spent on board activities when authorized, et cetera, et cetera. So it sounds like they're going to be getting up to $55 a day.
Ms. DeSalle.
Madam Chair, that is the provision that would be there for that. You know, for these board members, they're going to be putting a lot of time in. So their expenses and modest compensation, apparently, is what we're talking about here.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. DeSalle, could you just review for those of us that aren't extremely familiar with the reimbursement process for the guardian ad litem and how that works?
Madam Chair, Representative, The reimbursement process is primarily in the family law area where individuals can't afford to pay for a guardian ad litem. We have it is a judge determination of what that reimbursement level is. There are some guidelines that we've put out at various levels, but I think $1,200 is the highest rate. The reimbursement would go back to the program and allow it to continue to provide funding and for the program. But generally speaking, most of this of the activity here is in the CHIPS area, and there's very little reimbursement that comes with that. And in fact, the reimbursement level is about $500,000 statewide on an annual basis, and primarily from family cases.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Please come down and identify yourself.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shalene Johnson. I'm a former guardian ad litem and a member of the staff at the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. The Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women supports the transition of the guardian ad litem program to an independent agency and support the formation of a board of directors to oversee the work of the guardian ad litem programs. Since guardian ad litems are appointed on cases when issues of physical and sexual abuse of children are involved, a large number of cases also involve guardian ad litems are involving domestic violence and domestic abuse. There's a high degree of overlap between domestic violence and child maltreatment. Leading statistics talk about 30 to 60% of the children's that are their mothers are being abused. Also, these children are being abused themselves. Our coalition have member programs located throughout the state of Minnesota, and all of our programs work with guardian ad litems and work with families where guardian ad litems are involved. The problems that we've heard from our member programs is that there is consistently a lack of understanding around the impact of domestic violence on children, a lack of understanding on the connection between providing safety by the non-abusing parent and the protection of the children, the lack of responsiveness to the communities, lack of transparency with the entire guardian ad litem system. We think it's critical to have a board of directors that is more diverse than the one that is being proposed. We believe that there needs to be a clear designation of a seat on the board for someone knowledgeable in the area of domestic violence, and also need to see a designation of the seats of the board for various ombudsman's persons for family. All of us, our coalition and ombudspersons for families, have a long history of working with GAL issues and are knowledgeable about the legal system and the legal issues that impact these families. but we also know that we also bring specific and important information and knowledge from our constituents and communities. I thank you for that consideration.
Any other discussion to the bill?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to address that issue. We actually copied the Public Defense Board's example, and the court has decided that they think they can best deal with the other representation issues by creating an advisory council in which there will be all sorts of people with all sorts of diverse backgrounds and expertise advising the board. However, when you get a board that's very big, sometimes you don't have as effective of a board, and so we decided to copy the Public Defense Board structure.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
I'm sorry to keep going back to the fiscal here, but I'm just not sure what this is going to cost us. I mean, is it going to save us money from the way it's presently set up, or is it going to cost us more? Is that an unknown?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The goal is to use the same money that we currently have and just have it be an independent entity because of the issues of conflict of interest that have been raised. And so we understand that we have a fiscal crisis here, and so we are attempting to use exactly the same number of dollars as we currently allocate.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Hillstrom. Oh, Representative Westrom.
So, Madam Chair, just to be clear, we're getting rid of one oversight board and bringing in a different one. Is that we're not adding more layers here?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, actually, currently the Judicial Council supervises this directly. And the court has determined that they think that's a conflict of interest. And so the justices got together and the, I don't even know how many folks are on there, but they felt that it was important to have this be done by an outside board. So they have voted to set up this outside board, just like the Public Defense Board.
And to follow up on that,
Representative Westrom,
there would be savings because they're spending money doing this now, and they would limit staff or reduce staff or shift staff to other tasks that they would save with this?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Westrom, this isn't supposed to be a cost-saving measure. This is just supposed to spend exactly what we have and just make certain that the oversight is done by an independent board. And so it isn't, you don't have the appearance that the court is appointing the very person that's supposed to be independent and paying their salary, because it's pretty difficult to argue, of course, that you have an independent person that's not looking out for what the judge wants if the judge appoints them, hires them, pays them, and then they report to them. So this really is an attempt to make them independent.
Okay, I'm going to one last question because this is going to government ops. There'll be an opportunity for more questions. So Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your indulgence. Representative Hillstrom, one of the things I'm concerned about, and maybe be interested in your perspective on it, is kind of if they're in this whole system, if there is somebody that needs to appeal, and then just kind of the integrity of the board. I mean, we already heard one special interest group get up and say that they would like to have their seat at the table, and it seems that it's ripe for special interests to influence and possibly drive the direction of the board. I'd be interested in your response.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We actually copied the Public Defense Board, and so we believe that the Public Defense Board has worked for many, many years. And so, you know, when something works, we thought that it was a good model to copy.
All right. With no further discussion, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 2990 be passed and referred to, as amended, be referred to Governor Ops.
That's correct.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay?
No.
No.
Motion carries.
Madam Chair.
Sure.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Does this need to go anywhere else? Does this need to go anywhere else?
Having fun?
Does it need to go anywhere else?
Yeah.
Does it need to go anywhere else? Is it me? Does it need to go anywhere else? Okay. Madam Chair, I move that House File 2612 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee. With me, Madam Chair, is Sue Abder Holden, and they brought me this bill, and I'd like them to talk to you about it.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sue Abder Holden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. This is a very simple, non-controversial bill.
although that might jinx me, relates to the civil commitment process for people with mental illnesses and other disabilities. Over a year ago, NAMI met with, and a lot of the other mental health advocates met with county attorneys to talk about some of the problems with implementation of the Commitment Act. One of the problems we saw is that when a person is in a hospital and the hospital of the person's family is seeking civil commitment to get treatment, there's often confusion as to which county is responsible to do the pre-petition screening and then file a commitment petition. Courts are sometimes confused about which county a commitment case should be filed in. We have to remember that sometimes people are in a hospital in a county where they don't actually have residence, and so that's where some of the problems come in. With me today is, I'll let you introduce yourself, from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office.
Madam Chair and members, my name is John Kerwin, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. And the issues that arise under the civil commitment law relating to residence and what county a petition should be brought in arise for a few different reasons, but a lot of times they arise because people move from one county to another. A lot of times people are placed by one county in another county to receive services. But the general agreement in the scheme of the Commitment Act has been that the patient's county of residence, or for human services purposes, their county of financial responsibility, is the county that's responsible to bring the commitment petition. But nonetheless, with this movement between counties, there's been confusion about that, and the commitment law actually has used three different terms to refer to what I'll call the county of residence. They've used the term county of residence, they've used the term county of financial responsibility, and they've used the term county of settlement. And understandably, sometimes when these cases then get filed with a court administrator, and they're often filed at the last minutes with moments to go before a court order expires, a court administrator looks at this and it appears to them on the face of it, wait, this person is living in some other county. But really, they're living in that county because they're in a placement in a facility in that county. And so a number of groups looked at this and decided that it would be best to use a single term in the Commitment Act to refer to this county we're talking about that's responsible to bring the commitment petition and to do pre-petition screening. And the term that is in the bill is county of financial responsibility, which is a term that's defined in Chapter 256G of the statutes. It's well known to counties. There's a body of case law surrounding it. And so most of the changes in the bill make really that one change, to change some other non-uniform terms into this one term, county financial responsibility. The bill does just a couple of other things. The very first section of it basically says that when a county believes that it's the county of financial responsibility and has prepared the commitment petition, that the court administrator should accept that petition for filing, accepting the word of a county that it indeed it is financially responsible for this case. And then if something needs to be sorted out later. And there's a provision in here, Section 7, dealing with change of venue. But make sure that the commitment petition can be filed rather than have a problem with the hold order expiring because a court administrator is confused about what county is responsible. In addition to those two provisions that I mentioned, the first provision and then the venue provision, there's one other provision that has a bit of a substantive effect, and it's the last provision. And what it does is makes clear the understanding that's really existed among the counties up until this time, which is that the county where the patient resides or the county financial responsibility is primarily, has the first level of responsibility for filing a petition. And even though the statute says it can be filed in the county of financial responsibility or the county of presence, the county of presence is really a backup in case there's confusion and at the last moment somebody needs to file it. And these provisions, as Ms. Abderholden mentioned, have been discussed with the county attorneys, with the Association of Counties, with the mental health advocacy groups, with defense attorneys, with the Department of Human Services. Everybody we could think of to discuss this with, we have. And we think that people are on the same page and that these are the provisions they think would make the law clearer.
Sounds like it's been thoroughly vetted. Any discussion? Any questions? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would have maybe a question for, I don't know, Mr. Kerwin or the author. Page 1, Section 1, Subdivision 4CB, line 1.18 through 1.23. I'm wondering if there's an easier way to, or a better way to write that so that an average person can understand what we're saying there. All of the references that are included there, you know, is there a way that, you know, we'd have to spend a bunch of time really going to the statute books to understand what that's saying, and I'm thinking that there are county attorney staffs throughout Minnesota that are going to probably spend a lot of extra time trying to figure that out. Is there an absolute need to cite the sections of statute by reference there, or can we say things more plainly?
Mr. Kerwin.
Madam Chair and Representative, we chose this language pretty carefully, and the reason we did it, the statutory provisions that are cited there are statutes that are well known to the county attorneys who do this work, and they refer to petition for early intervention, pre-petition screening, and then filing the commitment petition. And part of the reason that paragraph B is written the way it is, it might appear that it's a bit more cumbersome than necessary, but the concern was that there might be a separation of powers problem if the legislature told courts, you shall not dismiss commitment petitions. And so instead, this is worded to say that the determination made by the county of financial responsibility is the operative determination. So that's the reason for some of the cumbersome language there. But we attempted to work it through pretty carefully to get it to work the way that we wanted it to work. And I believe that the people who work with this statute are very familiar with those provisions.
Any further discussion?
Just quickly, Madam Chair, thanks
very
for your indulgence.
Very quickly, it's 6:24.
So, Mr. Kerwin, I mean, as you look throughout Minnesota, most counties are going to have a high degree of familiarity with these statutes, is what you're saying. Most or all, or how would you characterize that?
Well, I would say that any, Madam Chair and Representative, Mr. I would Kerwin. Say that any county attorney who's doing a civil commitment case, it's a fairly confined section of the statutes, and so they pick up this chapter and they work through these provisions. And so I believe that somebody looking at this will quickly be able to go to those provisions if they don't know them off the top of their head and see what they are.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Seeing none and seeing no further discussion, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 2612 be passed and referred to Public Safety Policy and Oversight.
And Madam Chair, we were just debating. We actually don't think it even needs to go there. So if the committee doesn't have a problem, it could probably go to the General Register.
Well, I don't hear anybody bucking that. So seeing no further discussion, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 2612 be passed and referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion carries.
Thank you.
And I believe this meeting is adjourned.